So we have been doing what we mentors call popcorn for a while, just allowing the presenter to choose their own topic. And that's fun. But we've also found that the community really responds when we do a theme or a series. So starting tonight, we will be doing a new series that'll, we think, pretty much carry to the end of the year. And the title of that series is Difficult Emotions, Fight, Flight, Freeze, or Learning Opportunity. So I actually thought I would start by giving you a little window into the process of how we came up with that theme, decided to do that theme. It's a little bit less sort of traditional Theravadan teaching, you know, Noble Eightfold Path, Four Noble Truths, than we sometimes do, right? But when Dennis and Diane and I met last time, which we do quarterly, we just sort of shared, well, what's going on with the community? What are you hearing? What is it that people feel like they want to need? What are they sharing when they meet with you one-on-one? And people are really wanting some practical things that they can apply to their lives, and they're wanting this particular theme of working with emotions came up, difficult emotions. So, you know, I started thinking about the process and the intention behind this, choosing this theme, and I realized that it's really the same process as the five keys to right speech. When you speak, it needs to be true, right? Hopefully everything that we're teaching from up here is true. It needs to be beneficial, and that's what we were hearing from the community, that, you know, it'd be beneficial if you would please talk about this. It needs to be timely. No better time than Thursday night. And the last part, you know, the last two parts, needs to be spoken affectionately and with a mind of goodwill. And I can speak for Dennis and Diane on this one. You know, whenever we think of the community and what we're going to present next, whether it's us presenting it, actually, who are we going to invite in? Because we, along with the board, have a role in that as well. We're really always thinking about what would be really helpful for this community, and with a lot of affection and goodwill toward the community as a whole. So, as we begin this theme, and I'll be more of the 10,000 foot view today, I just thought I'd share that particular process that we went through in coming up with the theme. And then as we go with this, we'll actually be exploring individual emotions sort of one by one type thing at a time. So hopefully it will be practical and useful, and please give us feedback as we go and let us know what's working and what isn't. So how did we come up with this fight, flight, freeze, or learning opportunity? It's often said that this practice is one of going against the stream. And, you know, to me that applies on two different levels. There's the overall cultural level that dealing with difficult emotions is not what we do in this society. You know, they're stuffed, they're denied, they're downplayed, you'll get over it. You know, they're just not really concentrated on very much. And think about our own evolutionary wiring. The fight, flight, freeze comes from a description of what animals, not just human beings, but other beings do when they're faced with a traumatic situation suddenly, you know. If you're bigger and you think you can take on that thing, you know, fight, run toward it, take them on. You know, if they look bigger than you, head out as fast as you can. And, you know, then there's the deer in the headlights and just, ooh, you know, don't know what to do. It's just overwhelmed. And that's the freeze. So those are the kind of three evolutionary responses. And on so many levels, this practice that we are trying to learn here is a training in going against our evolutionary wiring to some extent. I mean, we need to work with it, right? You can't get rid of it. But it's going against that first instinct, you know, that first instinct, man, I really should have that difficult conversation with that person, but, you know, I can't stand it. It's too difficult. I'm going to postpone it till next week, type thing. So really what we're trying to do, as you know, in insight Vipassana practice, is to see things the way they are and be okay with that. And get beyond the fight, flight, or freeze, to actually engage the world. So we talk a lot about, or I like to talk anyway, a lot about how this practice is not going to free us from ever being angry again, you know, from ever being sad again. It's not going to take all that difficulty out of our lives. It's going to change our relationship to it, so that when those things arise, we have some other way of reacting other than just fight, flight, freeze, numb out, turn to our favorite addiction, whatever it might be, and to respond skillfully, both within ourselves and with other people. Because this practice is really about relationship. So rather than responding from these habitual reactions that are tied to our small sense of self, we're actually gradually moving to a place where we're not harming ourselves and others when we move forward in the world. And we engage the world. This is not about retreating to a cave, you know, and meditating by ourselves. This is about actually engaging the world more fully and more completely. And when we do that, we actually find that we have access to skills and insights, really, that turn into wisdom. I mean, that's what wisdom is. It's actually understanding, how does this mind-body work, and how can I actually make a change for the better so they don't cause as much harm to myself and to others. So, difficult emotions. What's your favorite? Anger, grief, shame, anxiety. What are some of the ones that come to mind when we bring up the general arena of difficult emotions?
These are the big ones.
Impatience.
Anger.
Anger
is a big one.
Fear.
Anxiety.
Fear.
Yeah, repeats are allowed here. We have these things in common, right?
Sadness.
Sadness, yeah.
Shutdown.
Shutdown, yep. Numbness, uh-huh.
Frustration.
Yeah. Thank you.
Harsh speech.
Our speech causes so many difficult emotional situations. Yeah. Yes, it does. Diane talked about doubt last week. I mean, that's not really what you might think of as an emotion, but it's certainly a difficult mental state, right? So I don't know how many of you have seen the movie Inside Out?
Yeah.
Quite a few, yeah. So full disclosure, my sister works for Pixar, so she may have a financial interest in my talking about this movie. But so there the emotions were anger, sadness, disgust. I mean, she was 11 years old, right? Mm-hmm. So
joy.
Disgust.
Enjoy.
Joy and fear, right? And what I really liked about that was that the way that so for those of you that haven't seen it, so these emotions are all inside this 11-year-old girl's head, and they're sort of up in command central, and they're sort of dealing with situations as they come up. And Joy's sort of in charge, and 11-year-olds are really joyful, and then, you know, 12-year-olds, it's a different story. So as the movie goes on, more and more difficult situations arise, and what she finds out through this, or what we find out by watching these emotions play out inside of her head, is that we can't be happy all the time. And if we are, it's not necessarily the most skillful thing. So this wonderful scene where they encounter this other creature inside, as they wander around inside of this person's head, and the person is sad. Joy tries to relate to this creature. No go. The person just shuts down. That can't be reached at all. When sadness sits down next to the person and sort of does her, kind of body language. She doesn't really say anything. The person just opens up to her. You know, sadness was able to reach the sadness in the other person. So to me, that was a valuable lesson that we make all these judgments about emotions, right? They're good, they're bad, they're positive, they're negative, they're difficult. I mean, even the name of this series is kind of a painting
they're
it, right?
Real to the human
they're just real. They're just the, not even just the human condition, right?
To the animal
other,
world. And
other creatures feel them as well, yeah. So they... The lesson there is that they're all valid. They're all just something to be experienced and to be aware of. And, you know, to the extent we can, if we can learn to not have a preference one for the other and to just deal with them as they come along, then we're really going to be able to make much more progress in our life. And it's just... really important, not only in the realm of emotions, but even in bodily sensations. You know, I'm sure for some of you, the room might be a little warm tonight. For those of you, whenever the AC kicks on, it might be too cold. And just on in any experience, it's just really important to be aware of that base sense of pleasant and unpleasant. And to just start from there and be aware of that. Saida Utejaniya, who's a Burmese teacher that actually... worked as a layperson for decades before he was fully ordained. He had a shop in Burma, and he observed people, and he did his best to stay mindful as he did this. So a lot of his, he didn't fully ordain until he was in his 40s, and a lot of his teachings are very applicable to everyday life. And he says, every experience, whether good or bad, gives you a learning opportunity. So we got that phrase. To notice whether the mind accepts things the way they are, or whether it likes, dislikes, reacts, or judges. Okay. So how do we actually learn what to do when these emotional states are difficult to face, and how do we unlearn our habitual patterns that often arise in response to these difficult emotions arising? We have talked many times up here about cause and effect. And with these emotions, just like everything else, we need to understand the process that causes them to arise, that causes them to be sustained, and that causes them to dissipate. It's like all of our experience. It's like any experience on the cushion or in daily life. We need to understand the process that causes things to arise, causes them to sustain, and then causes them to dissipate. So with difficult emotions and actually, you know, suffering of all kinds, even from the minor, most minor sense of irritation or dissatisfaction to the numbness, to full-blown rage, lust, etc., there is a process in Buddhism that explains that cause and effect. And it is often talked about as one of the two things that the Buddha sort of came up with completely on his own that weren't sort of adapted or inherited from the previous Vedic teachings. And this particular one, and hopefully... this is the only piece of Buddhist jargon I'll throw out tonight. And if I do slip into Buddhist jargon, I have a really good friend here, my wife, Mary, who's really good at calling me on that stuff. So just raise your hand or give me a signal if I lapse into any more Buddhist jargon after this. But just so you know, when you read about it in other places, this process is formally called dependent origination or codependent arising or dependent co-arising. There's various ways of talking about it. In Pali, it's paticca samuppada. Okay. So that's it for the jargon. And I just use those words so that when you do bump into them in other places, you'll know, oh, that's the same thing. Now, here, Dennis Warren, the founder of the Second Insight Meditation, has developed sort of a shorthand version of dependent origination that he calls the cycle of reactivity. So that's what's taught in our 6-week beginning class, and we have this big chart that we put up on the wall with the various lengths and the various ways it could be expressed. And maybe we'll bust that out before the end of this series. In the formal teaching of dependent origination, there are 12 links, 12 causes and conditions. One leads to the other as an explanation of this process of how and why we suffer. But some of those are sort of subconscious or preconscious. They're not necessarily things, even if we could be aware of them, that we can change. So, for example, our 6 senses, or 5, or however many you have, you don't really have that much control over that, right? I mean, you have vision or you don't. You have a sense of smell or you don't. You have your hearing or you don't. And when a sound arises, if you've got that sense, it's going to respond. It's just what our minds and bodies do. So no control over that one. Good to know that it exists. Good to know that it's part of the process, but nothing we can do about it. And, you know, we're not just here to understand suffering, right? We're here to do something about it. Yeah. We're here to understand what the cause of it is, to abandon it, and to find some peace eventually. So where we often begin the teaching of the cycle of reactivity is with this step called feeling tone. So as mentioned in the sitting, every experience in life has a feeling tone to it. We try not to use the word feeling because it gets mixed up with emotions. You know, we use the word feelings for emotions. So the language that we try to use in here is to use emotions for anger, fear, shame, loneliness, numbing out, etc. And we try to use the word feeling tone for that intuitive sense of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral that arises every time there's a contact at any one of the sense doors. So in this system, the idea is, get a little conceptual here, when a sound, you know, we in the scientific West believe that's a vibration of the airways, hits a healthy ear, and all the nerves that are required to make that ear work send a signal to the brain, sound. Hearing is happening. Okay. In that moment, there will be an intuitive reaction of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Okay. So for some of you, that may be a really pleasant sound. It might be conditioned from a retreat that you went on where you really got concentrated and you could really hear all the nuances in the bell and all the overtones. And maybe you were in a handbell choir in high school and you just loved the sound of any kind of bell. You know, maybe you took a trip to Kathmandu and spent some time in a bell shop and had a really nice interaction with the owner. Each of us will have a different life experience that will condition how we hear that bell. Now, for some of you, that sound might be unpleasant. You know, what if you worked on a submarine and got woken up by bells all hours of the night? You know? There could be different reasons that for some people this might be unpleasant. And then for some, couldn't care less. May not even hear it. Thinking about something else. It just you're just passing over it. It's just a neutral reaction. Not pleasant, not unpleasant. It's just there. That's true for pretty much every experience except for maybe chocolate. I think that's universal. Although I was allergic to that as a kid. But the chocolate was still pleasant. It was just the hives afterwards. So it's important to understand that each person has a different reaction, a different feeling tone out of a given experience based on their background. Some of the background is the other factors here that we're not going to go into detail tonight about, but they get into a little bit of why we're conditioned to be one way or the other with a certain kind of experience. Our personal history, our non-personal history, you know, sort of cultural upbringing, a lot of other things like that, that we won't go into. So that's feeling tone. And it's really important to understand that pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral are just that. It's just a base level intuitive feeling tone of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral that arises when any experience touches any one of the six sense doors with, you know, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and then the sixth one being thoughts in the mind. So when there are thoughts in the mind, each one of those brings a feeling of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Probably a lot of neutral ones, maybe more than a lot of the other experiences, where they're just zipping through and you're hardly even noticing, right? Because the mind's always generating thoughts. But pleasant, unpleasant, neutral comes with any one of the six sense doors. When there's contact, feeling tone arises. Okay. Now, if that feeling tone is not paid attention to, in other words, not brought to awareness, if we are not mindful of the pleasant or unpleasant or neutral feeling tone, the way that this cycle of reactivity works is that that's going to escalate. And the pleasant is going to escalate into desire. The unpleasant is going to escalate into aversion. We don't want it. And the neutral is going to escalate, if you will. It's going to kind of de-escalate into indifference or numbness. Okay. So that's why it's important to notice at the base level, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, and to be able to distinguish those with practice from desire, aversion, and indifference. We need to recognize when they've escalated to that next step. And the tool for that is mindfulness. I mean, that is how we keep pleasant, unpleasant, neutral at the level of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral without having them escalate up into desire and aversion. Sometimes that desire, aversion, indifference step is called craving. So you'll hear, you know, sometimes you'll hear the second noble truth expressed as the cause of suffering is craving, right? So it's that getting beyond the base experience of really physical sensation, even in the mind, it can be sort of a physical sensation, of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral at the contact, when there's contact. And getting beyond that to, ooh, I like this, or ooh, I don't like that. It's a leaning forward or a leaning away or a spacing out, the indifference one. Just, if you're not aware of the neutral tone, there's a spacing out. Okay. Now, if you don't notice that, the next step is what we often hear in pop Buddhism as being attachment. So we often hear, you know, don't be attached. But what they're really talking about with that is not that you shouldn't be attached to your pets, or you shouldn't be attached to getting your homework done on time, or wherever it might be. What they're talking about specifically is attaching to our experience as having to be some certain way. So when this pleasant escalates, because we haven't been mindful of it, we haven't noticed it, up into desire, if we don't notice it there, we got to have it that way. We have to have pleasant or we're not okay. And that's what we really need to watch for. Because as we move through the steps, at the level of feeling tone, it's pretty easy to notice what's going on and just say, hey, you know, that's a pleasant feeling. Oh, how is that pleasant? Oh, well, sort of warm feeling in the chest, and my breathing is free and easy, and my cheeks, you know, you can sort of break it down that way pretty easily. As it gets up into desire and aversion, it's much harder to do that. When you get to the attachment stage, it's much harder, because that's when things go from I want to I need. So that's a clue in your self-talk of the difference between the craving and the grasping, clinging, attachment, that next level and it's much more difficult to get out of, to back away from, to break the cycle. We can break this cycle of reactivity at any one of these steps, but it's becoming increasingly hard because we're getting tighter and tighter and tighter. Okay, we're closing around the object, either desire or aversion, and we're getting to the point where we need to have it a certain way, rather than just liking, leaning a little bit towards something, disliking, leaning away from something a little bit. No, now we're actually grabbing onto it or actively pushing it away. So it's a much more energetic relationship, and it's much more difficult to drop. The Pali word for that one that I won't give you, because I'm not going to use any more technical terms, is fuel. Fuel. So we're pouring gasoline on fire, is kind of the cliche in English, right? Pouring gasoline on the fire, either of desire or aversion. And the next one after that is identification. So we've got attachment and identification. Those are actually two more steps in this process. Identification, so in the previous one, we went from I want to I need. Now we're at I am. Okay. So let's go back to the unpleasant side. So there's an unpleasant feeling in the body. My heart's pounding really hard, my cheeks are, you know, red hot, and my fists are clenching. That's unpleasant. But at that level, it's just physical sensation, right? Now, when that feeling tone escalates to aversion, then it becomes, you know, I need to do something about this anger, or it's, you know, I'm not going to be okay. At the attachment stage, I am an angry person, or I am angry with you. That's identification. You know, I'm identifying myself with those unpleasant sensations, which have now escalated into something I'm choosing to label anger, although there's probably a lot of other things going on if we look closely. There might be some fear below that, there might be some shame below that. Complicated terrain, right? But, and that's why it's much easier to work back at that level of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, because that we can know experientially. Once we get up into this complicated territory of attachment and identification, it's getting more and more complex, more and more dense, more and more difficult to see. I mean, right, the fish can't see the water it's swimming in, you know, you've heard that phrase. Well, the person that thinks I am an angry person cannot see anger as, oh, anger is arising, you know. That's not a reality for that person. No, no, no. I'm an angry person because of what that other person said. And then the justifications start rolling out. Well, you know, I have every right to be angry because, you know, what they said was totally inappropriate and blah, blah, blah. We come out with all the rationalizations for our behavior, which, you know, as someone and I were talking about at the break, of course our behavior is always based on us being right. Because we're always right, right? At least when we're at this stage, we think we're always right. So that's the cycle. That's the cycle. When once we're there, that's extremely hard to get away from. I mean, it's really hard for the fish to get out of the water. You know, they don't even know they're in the water. How are they going to get out of it? So, you know, if I'm an angry person, how am I going to get out of being an angry person? I don't even know I'm angry. I think I'm an angry person. That's a completely different level of trying to deal with this stuff. So, there's a really nice quote. I've got a couple quotes tonight from the beginning class. I'm getting ready to do the beginning class again. And I've been kind of going over the essays and things, getting ready for that. And just as an introduction to the next part, which I hope will be a very practical investigation of how do we work through some of this stuff in the moment, is this quote from the essay for week 3 on feeling tones. Connecting the breath and body sensations to the feeling tones is especially useful in short-circuiting our reactivity. We can notice the urge of the feeling tone to intensify into desire, aversion, or indifference. And in that noticing, the cycle's broken. Okay. Once it gets up to into attachment, not so easy. So you have probably heard us talk in here before about there are three times to practice: before, during, and after. Right? And some of you that have been around for a while probably know that actually the first way we learn how to work with some of these difficult states is after. And it's just a reality. Okay? So I'm going to use a different order. We talk about it as before, during, and after because that's very chronological. But I have found in my practice and actually in discussing this process with a Dharma buddy, found that it's much more useful for me to change up the order, because this is how I have ended up actually walking myself through the process. So when we first start working with this process, it's always after. Once we get to the stage of identification, it's really, really hard to change or to stop the momentum of that cycle. Because what happens is you get up into that identification stage, I am an angry person, that generates more unpleasant feelings. Those unpleasant feelings generate more aversion. That aversion generates more attachment and identification. So that's what's called a cycle. It just keeps feeding itself. It's an unhealthy cycle. It just keeps feeding itself. Because by the time we're identified, we're not going to be able to notice those unpleasant feelings the next time they come up. So, you know, the initial thing, you might be angry because of something that somebody said to you, and then the next round of unpleasant feelings might be reacting from a thing of shame. And then the anger escalates, and maybe the next round of unpleasant feelings is coming out of a place of fear. Oh, what if this anger explodes and I hurt somebody, you know? Keeps it escalating. So often, it's really hard in that moment to stop during the cycle. So after the cycle, hopefully many of you meditate once in a while. It's really helpful. I recommend it. And when you do that, you know, the instruction that we normally give for Vipassana Insight meditation is notice whatever arises and just be okay with it and don't try to change it and just kind of go with it and investigate it and see where it shows up in your body and is there tension somewhere, or, you know, that sort of thing. Very, very, it's not passive, but you're not trying to make something happen. But there's a parallel process that's very useful in actually learning and acquiring wisdom, that's meditative reflection. So we actually use the form of the meditation, so we find a quiet place, we perhaps close our eyes, we allow our breathing to come to its natural state, but then we purposefully call up a situation and reflect on that. So, for example, if I have just gone through this particular unhealthy cycle of anger, shame, and fear that I just went through this afternoon with my boss, when I sit down that evening, I actually consciously bring up, well, what was that like? How did that feel at that time? And reflect on that after the fact. Now, I've done this a few times, and my guess is that it's going to be really painful to look at that. Not only how it felt in the moment, because When you sit and reflect like that, you can actually bring up, I mean, if you have some level of mindfulness, you can actually bring up the physical feeling of what that felt like. I mean, I can actually feel the heat in the cheeks and the rapid heartbeat. The heartbeat actually starts beating rapidly again. I mean, the psychologists have done this. They've done the wires in the brain thing, and they have somebody recall an emotion, and all the parts of the brain line up that lit up when they had that emotion. You're actually having that experience again. So in the meditative reflection, though, we have the added advantage of some level of mindfulness. We also have the added advantage that we're not staring at another person. So if it gets out of control, you can just open your eyes and stand up and take a drink of water and get a deep breath and start over again, right? So you're doing this meditative reflection, you look at this experience, and I'm not going to try to put words in your mouth, but my guess is when you do that, it's going to feel really painful. So the first thing to know is that you got to stay there. I'm sorry, but you have to stay there. There's no way to understand these states without feeling the pain of them. Because if you think about it, well, maybe some of you don't have any anger issues, but I do. And I know that anger, it's, you know how when you cut yourself, the body kind of goes into shock, and it kind of makes it hurt less for a while, until, you know, a couple hours later, then it starts hurting like heck. But at in the moment, everybody's like, oh, you know, oh, I'm okay, I'm fine. Spurt, you know. But so the body does that, the mind does that too. When I'm angry, I'm feeling no pain. I mean, I'm in that moment, when I'm really angry, when I'm in rage, I'm feeling nothing except that anger. And it's all consuming. You know, in that moment, that's the identification save. I am an angry person. It's not something over here that I'm looking at, no way. But in the meditative reflection, you can actually do that. You can actually look at that state and feel the pain of it. We've got to do this, folks. We have to do this, you know? I mean, there's several, just I think all of us have said up here, there's two kinds of suffering. One that just leads you into more suffering, and the one that gets you out of suffering. Why does it get you out of suffering? Because it gives you the motivation to feel the pain, be able to stay with it long enough to be motivated to want to do something about it, to want to actually change your relationship to those emotions, to the people around you, so that you can get a handle on this cycle of reactivity. You can start breaking it at an earlier stage than, I wish I hadn't said that. I'm going to regret that for a long time. Some stage earlier than that, you know, even if it's the first five words come out and you stop. And we'll talk about that when we get to during. Okay? So that's after. And does that make sense? The value of after. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's after. Oh, this is cool. I love spell check. You know, you learn so many cool things from spell check. So I'm typing this way. And resolve to do better the next time. And I look at the page, it's got a red line under it, and it says, re-love. I love that. Re-love. You know? You're resolving to do better next time. You're re-loving. You're actually coming to the place where you can love again this thing that in the moment was just this angry person. Not very lovable, right? But when you get to the point where you can realize, hey, I'm just a human being that didn't notice pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. It escalated by a very lawful process that, you know, has been around and understood and explained for 2,600 years, and I'm just the latest victim of it. You know, and as I say these words, there's probably 10 more people doing the same thing out there right now. So, to re-love ourselves through this process, because, and just realize, hey, we're just human. And we actually do have the possibility to change. I get this daily. They call it the daily Tejaniya. So it's a little email that this guy from Rochester, Minnesota sends out every morning with a little reminder, a little one-sentence thing. Well, this one's two sentences. But one or two sentences from Tejaniya that just remind you. And he sent one out and he botched it. It was all messed up. So then like an hour later, he sends out this one. Recognizing mistakes is an important part of being aware intelligently. We all make mistakes. It is natural to do so. If you find you have made a mistake, accept and acknowledge it and try to learn from it. So that's Sayadaw Tejaniya's deal. It's learning. It's wisdom. You've heard his second book, you know, Awareness Alone is Not Enough. Well, the other piece is wisdom. So his third book, Always Everywhere, talks about awareness plus wisdom. He's constantly, how do we learn from what we're doing? So one way to learn about these difficult emotions is to learn after by meditative reflection. Now, once we've done the meditative reflection, We're not quite ready to do it in the moment yet. I know Buddhism's all about being in the present moment and all that stuff, but we're not quite there yet because we have to practice before. So you've heard us talk a lot in here about the power of intention, right? Okay. So part of learning to deal with whatever difficult stuff we're dealing with in our lives is learning our own patterns. What is it that triggers us? What is it that sets us off? What are our particular favorite dysfunctional mind states? What are our favorite dysfunctional or difficult emotions? What are they? Get to learn what they are. The only way you can do that is to be with them, like I said before. To be with them, learn what they are, and then start learning patterns. Because cause and effect, causes and conditions, this whole practice is about recognizing patterns. What leads to what leads to what? Well, ignoring a pleasant feeling in the body leads to desire, that leads to something else, okay, an escalation. So, in practicing before, what we do is that we take what we've learned about our patterns and we use it to set an intention to basically to re-love, to do better next time. So, for example, if that sort of kind of made up example that I used before about anger and shame and fear arising in a conversation with my boss, the next time I'm going into a meeting with my boss, before I go in, I remind myself, oh, that didn't go so well last time. What happened? Can I understand the process of what went on? And I've done this reflection afterwards, I understand, oh yeah, unpleasant feeling in my body arose, I didn't notice it. That turned into anger arising, but I didn't notice that. All of a sudden I was an angry person and I was saying things I shouldn't have said. And then shame came up, and then that fueled another cycle of it, and then fear that I was going to lose my job or say something really, really bad came up, and then that fueled another cycle, and etc. So we're going into the next encounter aware of what our patterns are, what our triggers are, maybe the word that she said that set me off. Maybe it's just a word. Some of us have, you know, triggers based on a single word. Or maybe it's certain kind of body language that really annoys us, or maybe it's every time she brings up that coworker that's always doing stuff better than us. Whatever it is, the pattern, we start to understand the pattern so that when it shows up, we can be like Buddha on the night of his enlightenment. Mara, I see you. That's all he had to say, and Mara disappeared, right? Mara, I see you. Okay. Difficult mind state, I see you. Anger, I see you. You're arising, I see you. No, I'm not going to let you just go working on me unconsciously anymore. I see you. So going into this meeting, okay, we're aware. Before, we remind ourselves, well, what is it that set me off last time? What are my patterns? What should I watch out for? And so we're going in with the intention of doing better this time and of being aware of what's happening in the moment. Okay? So we practiced after, we practiced before. Now we're ready to practice during. So, walk into the meeting. Hi, how you doing? Fine. We're already speaking. It's already dangerous territory, right? The minute we open our mouth, dangerous territory. So, what we need to do is, in speaking, we need to be mindful not only of our speech, but also of everything that's going on behind it, the intention. How are you? Is that the same as how are you? No. Why? Because the intention behind it is different. Words are the same. If you're reading in a book or reading in an email, same. But when you're saying it to another person with all the body language and the tone and all of that, one more thing to be aware of. So, the during practice, sorry folks, it's a little bit complicated. And that's why we fail so often. It's not like sitting in a cave, you know, looking at these abstract emotions arising and disappearing. This is the real world. This is where the rubber meets the road. So there's a lot going on in just a two-person conversation. So, you know, I'm sure you've all had the leadership training where they say 70% of language is nonverbal, right? You've all heard that one. So, but what do we normally do? We normally, person's talking, and, you know, we're sort of half listening to what they're saying. And the other 90% of our attention is on what we're going to say next, right? Or on making up a defense for what they said. Or of remembering the last time this didn't go so well and, you know, getting ready to really blast them when they bring that thing up, and that way we'll, you know, fight, flight, or freeze. We'll fight, we'll hit first, best defense is a good offense, you know. All those kind of really unskillful things that hopefully we're here to learn not to do. So, practice Turing. Let's start with the part of the transaction where the other person is speaking. Okay. Something more than 50%, I can't put numbers on it because it's not quantitative, but something more than half of your attention has got to be on that other person. Otherwise, you're not listening. Okay. So, but remember, they have both words going on and nonverbal stuff going on. So they've got the tone of voice, they've got the body language, all of that you need to pay attention to. Facial expression, you know, are their hands clenched up in fists? You know, is their message light flashing on their phone? Whatever. I mean, just be aware of them and their environment with more than half of your attention. Let's call it 60%. The other 40 has got to be on your internal process. How those words are hitting you, what they're triggering, what you learned from the last time when it didn't go so well, watching out for those triggers, all of that has got to be that 40%. Okay? So we're listening to what the person says. We're not planning what we're going to say next. We listen to them. We're really hearing them. We're listening not only to the words. We're listening to the nonverbal that's behind the words. And beyond that, we're listening for the intention behind the nonverbal that's behind the words. Just as we're trying to become aware of our own intentions, we're actually trying to become aware of the intentions of the other person. Are they really trying to get us? Maybe not. Maybe that was just a layer that we added to it because of some bad experience we had in the past. So we're really trying to be there in the present. And hey, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. I mean, maybe they are trying to get you, but you won't know that for sure until you really pay attention to what they're saying. To the words, the nonverbal, and the whole environment. Okay? So that's half the transaction. Now it's your turn to speak. And now we have to shift. Attention has to shift. Because speech is so difficult, we need to put most of our attention on our own process. Okay? So we need to notice our intention before we open our mouth. We need to notice what words we're choosing and why. We need to say them and be aware of our body language and the way that we're coming across, our tone of voice, the volume, the pitch, all of that in the moment, all of our internal process. Again, let's call it 60-70-30 because you've got so much going on because you actually know what's going on internally. When the other person is speaking, you really don't. You're just trying to do your best to be sensitive to it. But when you're speaking, let's say 70% of your attention, of the energy that you have available to you for awareness, is on what you're saying and everything behind it. The energy behind it, the intention, all of that that's behind the words and what you're really trying to communicate. It's actually not that straightforward. Often if we look closely, our motives are mixed when we speak. There may be a primary motive of, I'm a really nice guy, and there may be a secondary motive of, and if this other person doesn't get it, you know, or if this other person understands that, then maybe I'll get a bonus next month. No, they're just mixed. It's just the way it is. So in that moment, try to notice as much as we can everything that's going on within us, the words, and then that other 30% or whatever it is, on how the other person's reacting in the moment. Is what I'm saying getting them fired up, or are those bald fists relaxing? you know, is, are they glancing over at that message light every 5 seconds and maybe, is this a bad time for you? Should I come back in half an hour when you've had a chance to get your messages? Because after all, I'm in here at 8:01 and you haven't had a chance to do that yet, 8:01 in the morning. So, all of that. And then the other useful tool with pause, during is pause. Just some kind of pause. I don't know how many of you follow the crazy stuff with the stock market today, but and all this week and all last week, and the last 15 years. But they have now built into those algorithms a pause, where they actually shut down the market for a while. Did you hear the reason that it crashed on Monday? It crashed on Monday because all of the experienced people are on vacation. I'm not kidding. They had the U.S. editor of the Financial Times of London, and they asked her, why did things so volatile? Well, because they went on vacation. All the experienced hands went on vacation. The cycle of reactivity. People that are used to the market going up and down can deal with it. They can be there with that pain of, in the last 30 seconds, my client just lost $1.2 million. Right? I mean, that's reality for these guys, these people. They can be there with that. They can sit there with that. And they can wait for the right moment. They can calm down, take a breath. Take a pause. Okay, it's okay. I've seen this happen before. Well, apparently they were all at, you know, Long Island. And they didn't notice. You know, they were gone. They had their cell phone on, I'm sure. But, you know, things move quickly these days. So they weren't able to tell their junior partner to knock it off. Quit selling so rapidly. So, but there are algorithms built into the system where they actually have learned that just telling that market to take a pause sometimes helps. Now, in this case, it didn't, because the junior varsity was in charge. But in most situations, it actually helps to have the market just pause. I think, and maybe you heard the story, but I think it's up to 15 minutes. You can actually make the electronic market shut down for 15 minutes. Well, we don't have that luxury, you know. We're talking to our boss. Things aren't going so well. We don't have 15 minutes, you know. But do we have time for one breath? One breath, you know, especially when they're talking? Of taking one breath and really noticing that one breath? Or how about, do we have enough mindfulness that we can be aware of our left foot touching the ground or the top of our shoe or whatever it might be for the entire conversation? Maybe. Some of you have been practicing for a while. Maybe you could actually be aware of the sensations in your left foot for an entire conversation. And doesn't have to be hard, right? I mean, notice the sensations in your left foot right now. How much effort does that take? Not very much. So if, when you're in conversation that you are worried, maybe difficult, try that. Try the sensations in your left foot. Try the, you know, your hands touching. Try being aware of one breath in the course of that conversation. That pause can really be helpful. There's a kind of momentum, this cycle of reactivity where very, very, very quickly, you know, these things that we're talking about, the escalation, like from the contact to the feeling tone, instantaneous. From the feeling tone to desire and aversion, almost instantaneous. I think the neuroscientists are now saying that what the people that wrote the Abhidhamma 2,300 years ago called a mind moment is 1/200th of a second. That's the virtual instantaneous that we're talking about here, of just how long it takes for pleasant or unpleasant to arise from a contact. So a pause of one breath, that's a lot of mind moments that could have been leading you down the wrong path. So one breath, it's okay. The other thing is, like if this difficult conversation's on the phone, this one's worked well for me before. Oh, look, I need to just take a break from this conversation right now. Can I get back to you in half an hour? You know, or oh, you know, something really urgent's just come up, if it really has, it helps to be truthful. You know, but I mean, you're working at home and your daughter just walked into the room, right? Hey, can we just pause the conversation right now? I've got something that I've got to attend to. I'll get right back to you. That break is just very, very helpful. Any kind of break, even one breath. So that's practice theory. Sadhu Tejaniya says, right attitude allows you to accept, acknowledge, and observe whatever is happening, whether pleasant or unpleasant, in a relaxed and alert way. And that's such a tool. That's mindfulness, right? That's awareness plus wisdom. Right attitude is being willing to accept whatever comes along, whether pleasant or unpleasant, and be okay with that. So I wanted to finish tonight with another quote from the beginning class. As with all of practice, it is best not to struggle as we work with feeling tones and reactivity, or to be harsh with ourselves for falling into the trap of suffering again and again. It is healthier to have a curious, patient, and calm approach to practice. When we wake up and act skillfully, it is beneficial to rejoice, be happy with our success, and to take delight in the wholesome states that we create. My spell checker would call that relove. So we've got a few moments for questions, comments, experiences, difficulties. Yes.
Rich, I was wondering if, you know, you talked about the process of remaining in the moment when the difficult interaction mm-hmm. is occurring. And I recognize that it's better to disarm the bomb than to let the bomb explode, but there's a lot of tension that's involved with disarming the bomb, and there's a lot of tension involved in remaining mindful through a difficult conversation or interaction. Do you have any advice for once you're out of that, if your nerves are jangly or...
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of tension that arises in the interaction, but the process of disarming the bomb is noticing the tension and allowing it to relax. Actually, notice the tension, notice where it is in the body. This is all about the body and the breath. Mm-hmm. Being in the moment is all about noticing the sensations in the body and breath. So noticing that tension and actually consciously relaxing that is the first step in stepping into this cycle and interrupting and stepping back. So it's all about the somatic awareness of, that's why the left foot thing can be useful. Because it's not relevant to our experience in the moment, right? It's not directly related to anything, but it's like a touch point to the body. And then when the heart starts racing or the shoulders start coming up and these neck muscles in here start tensing, we actually can notice that, you know, tension arising, take a breath, and allow it to relax somewhat. It's not going to relax completely, but the momentum of that building, tenser and tenser and tenser, can be, oh, well, maybe we'll stay at the same tension for a while, or maybe even decrease a little bit. So notice the breath in the body. That's it. Now, you know, eventually we can actually notice mind states when they're happening, but that's more challenging. That's why the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, can I use that phrase?
Yeah.
He's smiling, I can use that phrase. In the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, it starts with the breath in the body. That's the first one. The second one is this feeling tone we're talking about. Then we get into the mind states. So they're more and more subtle. And when you're in a heated conversation with somebody, you're not going to notice subtle. No. You're going to notice the heart pounding, the cheeks getting hot, forehead, you know, the frown sort of coming on, mouth turning down, the trapezius muscles here tensing up, the shoulders coming up, stomach tightening, any of those, you'll notice them. And then to be able to kind of relax and start backing them off is just, it's the way to go.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anything else?
Yes. I've been in my life practicing, you know, it's almost like a mantra, pause when agitated or calm the disturbance, because I've always known that, not always known, I've learned it through the process, that anything I say, think, or do in that state of mind will only generate more of the same, and now it makes sense why.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that cycle of reactivity.
Right.
So I've learned that I have this emotion. Well, if I want this emotion, uncomfortable as it is, to continue, open my mouth, act on it, think, I mean, I can't even think of a solution. I have to calm it.
Right.
So that means walking away, taking a breath, pausing, you know, I mean, I just had one a couple of days ago, and he was so reactive, and I was like,
yeah.
You know, and I was just like, you know, but I'm going to do the reflective meditation because I think I got a little too interactive, but because it just kind of came up.
Sure.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
But so that, yeah, actually this is the first time I've actually heard it. And so you did a really good job of being very practical and,
good.
You know, well, yeah, made a lot of connections, a lot of little aha's happened to me. So.
Yeah, and the other thing as you work with this, we always talk about practicing internally and externally. So the practicing internally is what you talk about, you know, calm the disturbance, as in you meant within yourself,
not the other person. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But noticing that reactivity in that other person, that's a step in developing the wisdom. Because in noticing the reactivity in the other person, we learn more readily to recognize it in ourselves. Because sometimes some of these difficult things, we tend to go over toward denial, numbing out, not admitting that, oh, actually we do get angry once in a while. You know, there's a tendency, as we talked about at the very beginning, particularly supported in this culture, of not acknowledging those difficult states, but rather thinking, well, they shouldn't be arising. And we know from our practice that's not reality. They will arise. The skill is dealing with them once they arise. So by practicing externally, by watching others in a reactive state and seeing what happens as a result of that, we can do that, what we were talking about at the beginning, of, oh, that is painful. That is, I don't want to go there. So we can actually thank the other person in a way.
I usually, if a difficult person comes, what is my life trying to teach me
right now?
And that takes me out of the emotion or the reactivity. And
right.
Yeah, and I heard that when you have strong emotion, that it actually hijacks your frontal lobe, your executive center. And so by simply labeling it or saying painful, you're actually re-engaging that intellect, mm-hmm. The flood of the emotion coming over. So I thought that was pretty insightful too.
Good, thank you. Yeah.
Do you have any pointers on identifying when reflection becomes rumination and thinking?
Back to the body. Because rumination and thinking won't completely take over as long as we're connected to the body in some way. So as you're reflecting and as you recall some difficult mind state, notice where that shows up in the body and the qualities and characteristics of that, just like we do in meditation or with the breath. Noticing what kind of somatic reaction that brings up. It's only when we lose touch with the body and the breath that the thoughts can just start spinning on their own without any kind of stop. And then on the identification, that actual process of identification, when the rumination is happening, it's very helpful for me to remember kind of the roles I've played in that interaction. Because roles are a nice way of recognizing, oh, I am not that. That's just the state I was in that moment. So, you know, when the conversation started, I might have been an employee. You know, when the person shamed me, I might have been a 6-year-old child. When I, you know, got angry and started shouting at that person, I might have been the father figure, right? So by recognizing that we constantly, in our course of our day, are shifting roles from one identity to another, we realize actually there is no solid, ongoing, permanent identity at the center of this thing I call me at all. it's constantly shifting. And so in doing the reflection, if we can be aware of the way that those states shift, then it helps us not to get so identified. Or were you using identified in the sense of labeling? Because sometimes when we're ruminating, it's helpful to name things, and other times it becomes an abstract intellectual exercise and it just helps the rumination go. Yeah, so in the reflection, don't spend a lot of time trying to fine-tune these labels. Oh, was that anger or was that rage, you know? Don't worry about that. I mean, as long as you're in the kind of the general vicinity, because what we're trying to do is back this process up, right? We're trying to get it back to aversion, and then back to unpleasant, and notice it. So whether it was anger or rage, it was something in that territory. We shouldn't, if you can't figure out what the label is, that's wrong effort. It should be very obvious once we're in a reflective state of what that is. So we should be able to identify it. Just slap any kind of label, if that process is helpful to you. Slap a label on it and then move on. Don't spend a lot of time. Exactly how angry was I? No, that's not where we're going with this. Yes?
When I find myself ruminating, when I can remember to do this, I think that's a really painful place.
Uh-huh.
And I try to just feel what that's like in my body.
Yeah.
To get out of the bloodstream.
Right.
And just feel that and to feel it. I love that image of holding it like a baby.
Yeah, yeah.
With just a lot of compassion for the pain of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that can sort of lead to a more spacious
thing. Right. Yeah, or some people find like a hand on heart when you're doing this kind of reflection. There's a lot of pain, hand on heart, or both hands on the heart. It's as a somatic way of reconnecting with that re-love, that re-loving. Can be helpful. Because, yeah, it's painful, but we've got to go through it. But, you know, we need to do it with some care and some kindness toward ourselves. We're not going to get anywhere just by beating ourselves up. So we do need to end here. But I'll be around if people have questions or comments. And I know all of us have people in our lives that are suffering. My mother went into a cardiac unit in a hospital today. Our good friend Roseanne Fleming, who is our St. John's coordinator, is ill right now, and Vic would like us to keep her in our hearts. So for our closing tonight, just recalling how precious this human life is, and how fortunate we are to have a community of people who really have an intention of goodwill and who are really open to exploring the difficult areas within their lives and doing something about it, or really reducing suffering. So may we take any positive energy, any skills that we may have picked up or ideas for practice that we may have picked up today, and take those with us as we move out into the world and really bring with all of that a dedication to freeing all beings from suffering. May we all be safe and protected. May we be peaceful and happy. May we be as healthy and strong as our current circumstances allow. May we find true ease in our engagement with the world, and may all beings be free.